Today is our 25th and final message from the book of Exodus. We started our Exodus series in January of 2021, and I was looking back on some of the earlier messages, and that very first Sunday, I asked the question, like with everything going on in life, and this was coming out of 2020 and the pandemic, with everything going on, like why Exodus, right? Why are we going through Exodus instead of doing some series on how to deal with whatever you fill in the blank? Why are we going through Exodus instead of talking about anxiety or uncertainty or vision or relationships? 2020 was a tough year. What we didn't realize is that the last 60 to 90 days for us made 2020 feel like, I don't know, Alabama Mercer game or something, right? Like a cakewalk. That's kind of how we feel about 2020 in light of the last few months. And I said back on that very first week that ultimately the answer to that question is, like, why Exodus? Is because Exodus is about who God is and about how big God is. And a right view and understanding of God shapes every aspect of our lives. That a proper view of God helps us get beneath some of those things we were talking about, to get beneath our worries, to get beneath our doubts, to get beneath our anxiety, to get beneath our addictions and our struggles and our relationship problems. Like a healthy view of God puts life in proper perspective. A healthy view of God reminds us that God is in absolute control, that God was not caught off guard. God in 2020, when the pandemic happened, was like, oh man, I didn't really plan for this. What's going on? That God, when we got word, like, you need to be out of your space in 90 days, it didn't catch God off guard. Called us off guard. Didn't catch God off guard. God was in absolute control. He is sovereign and in control. And that gives us faith. It gives us hope. And so it's helped us remind ourselves weekly and regularly of how big God is. Now, in contrast to that, if it's up to me, a diminished view of God increases stress, right? It heightens uncertainty. It complicates life problems. Because when I have a diminished view of God, I feel like everything's up to me. I got to figure this out. I got to take the steps. I got to go to the next level. And so when we have kind of a diminished view of God, it shapes how we live life. That's why it's so important to have this big, robust view of how big God is, how powerful God is. And Exodus has invited us into that. It has invited us into this idea of how big God is, to know God better, to see more fully His redemptive plan, to draw out those kind of crucial life lessons for how we live out our faith in everyday life. And most importantly, the Exodus series has pointed us again and again to our true and final and ultimate rescuer, Jesus Christ, who would fulfill all the things that we've been talking about in the book of Exodus. So, little did we know when we started this Exodus series how crucial the truths that we have unpacked each week would be to this next season of City Church, because we have been in our own little Exodus. Again, we've kind of joked about it along the way, and people are like, did you plan this? I'm like, no. It's kind of a God thing, right? That we're preaching through Exodus while we are exiting our space. And so while we're in the middle of this kind of mini Exodus in the season of City Church, it's been important to recognize that God is sovereign, that God is in control, that when we go through our Red Sea moments of life, that God is in absolute control, like He was in the Exodus story. Now, it's been quite a journey since January as we've gone through Exodus together. We started out with Pharaoh's oppression and enslavement of the Israelite people, of the birth and this kind of miraculous preservation and calling of the deliverer of God's people, Moses, all the way to the supernatural deliverance of God's people from Egypt, the plagues and the Red Sea and all of that. And then we've watched His protection and provision of His people in the wilderness as they have pressed toward the promised land that God had promised them. But when we last left Israel last week in Exodus chapter 32, like they had kind of fallen back, hadn't they? Had fallen back into their idolatrous ways by forming and worshiping this golden calf as they lost patience waiting on Moses to return from his time with God on Mount Sinai. If you remember the story, if you're here last week, if you weren't, go back and listen to it. But God was ready to annihilate the whole group. And Moses steps in as a mediator and pleads for God to be merciful to his people. And he was. God was merciful. His judgment was limited as Moses called the people to repentance. Well, it seems like things are patched up, that all is well and all is good until we jump into chapter 33, which is where we're at this morning. The Lord said to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'To your offspring I will give it.'" And here's God's promise. Verse 2, "I will send an angel before you." We've heard this before, right? "I'll drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites." Verse 3, "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey." So like all these promises of God, like things seem to be patched up. Like, go. Like, I'm going ahead. I'm sending an angel ahead of you. Go to this land flowing with milk and honey, this promised land. But then the catch here at the end of verse 3, which is just wrenches the heart out of the people, as God says, "But I will not go up among you. I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way. For you are a stiff-necked people." Verse 4, "When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments." So God says, go up. Pack your bags. You're headed to the promised land. You will get what you want. You'll get blessings. You're going to get the land. You're going to get protection. My angel's going to go before you and drive out your enemies. You're going to have wealth. It's the land flowing with milk and honey. You're going to get all these things that you want. All these blessings, all these gifts. You're going to get all of that. And then God says, but you will not get me. You'll not get me. I will not be going with you. And the people wept. They mourned. The whole purpose of the Exodus event was for God and his people to be together in relationship. And now God is saying, you get the promised land, you get the gifts, you get the blessings, but you do not get me. And the hearts of the people are broken. They mourn the news. You say their desire for God's gifts, as we've seen again and again, their desire for his gifts over God himself leaves them without his presence, without his power. We are so prone to live life this way. The gifts of God over God himself. The presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, the presence, gifts of God over the presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, presence of God. We get his gifts, we get his blessings, but we don't always get God. We want his benefits, don't we? And we're very intentional about the benefits. I'll take that. Like, I want to get up in the morning and breathe. Like, I want your air, God. Keep sending the oxygen my way. Keep providing, right? Again, these Israelites, they're walking out of their tent every morning like heavenly miracle bread on the ground. Like, we'll take the manna. Keep providing the manna. Keep giving me the gifts. We're the same. We're so prone this way. I'll take the gifts. I'll take the blessings. I'll take the, you know, I don't have to work for my oxygen. I'll take the food. I'll take the healthy body. I'll take all the things that I'm receiving, right? We are so prone to be drawn toward the gifts of God that we don't always care about having God himself. Not only that, but I would take it to a deeper level to say that we have that expectation, don't we? We have the expectation that God's going to keep sending me his gifts. That I'm going to wake up every morning and the sun's going to come up and I'm going to be able to breathe. And either though all these things are the gracious gifts of God, we kind of now have this expectation. God, send me the gifts. Keep giving me your blessings. Keep giving me your grace. Keep putting the manna on the ground every morning when I get up. And I would challenge us to say, may the cry of our hearts be that of the Israelites in this crucial moment. Basically, the Israelites are saying, God, we would rather remain in the wilderness, the desert, with God than to enter the promised land without God. We'd rather live in the desert with you than to go into this land of blessing without you. And our hearts mourn at the idea. The blessings, the benefits, the gift, they're awesome. But if we do not get God, we've missed the very purpose of our existence, that we are created for Him. And we'll see this in a moment, but if we're left there, like, we're no different than the rest of the world that doesn't even profess to know God. Their expectation is the gifts of God. That I'm going to breathe every day, I'm going to have my needs met, things are going to be provided for me. Like, if we don't get God, we're just in that same category. We're no different than everybody around us. Which is exactly where the Israelites were left. Our hearts cry through this season of City Church. For us, and hopefully for you in this process, is God, give us you. Like, we want a space. We want a building. But without you, it's all meaningless. Can I be honest with you? Like, I'd rather be homeless than trying to do ministry without His presence, power, and provision. I'd rather not have a space. I'd rather not have four walls to gather in than to think about doing ministry, right? Without His presence and power. We need God. We need Him. We love His gifts. What if we adopted this passion in life? God, give us you. We don't want to live life without you. The gifts are awesome. They're gracious. They're good. But they are meaningless if we do not live life with the power and presence of God. Next section, I'm not going to read it all. It's kind of a flashback to what has happened before. Moses again steps in and intercedes for the people. I'll read just one verse, verse 16, because it's an important verse. 33:16, this is Moses speaking. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight and the people? Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? Moses is interceding, he's pleading, he's imploring God, like, God, we have to have you. We need your presence. We need you. And Moses says in this verse, God, your presence is essential because it's your presence that makes us distinct. Again, there's nothing unique about Israel here. There's nothing that makes them special. It's not their wealth, they're slaves. It's not their morality or their goodness or their righteousness. They're worshiping a golden calf at the foot of the mountain. It's not their righteousness that, right, compels God to be drawn to them. It's not the land. They're not even there yet. It is their relationship with God that makes them unique. It is that one central truth that we have seen over and over again in Exodus. There is no God but our God. There is no God like you. That's what makes them unique. That's what makes them different. They are His people. This is so relevant in our culture, in our day and age. It's so relevant because we have such an innate need for validation, don't we? That we need to be affirmed, we need to be validated, and we see this played out so many different ways in our lives. From posting on social media, we have to get likes, we have to get attention, we have to have people giving us the thumbs up, we have to get the approval from the boss, we need the person in our life, the speaking affirmation over us. And these are all good things, right? I'm not saying you should not, you know, be validated and encouraged by those around you. But we are driven sometimes for that. We have this innate need for validation and we seek it in so many ways. But if we seek our ultimate validation, listen, if we seek our ultimate validation in anything outside of God, it leaves us empty and searching. Like, go pick up tabloids, right? Checking out at the grocery stores, that still happens. Pick up tabloids, look at it, read People magazine. Look at people that have it all together, right? Successful, money, famous. Read behind the scenes of their lives. They've obtained everything we're searching for when it comes to the category of validation, and yet our headlines are filled with people who are empty and still searching and wanting more. Look around you. Look internally at yourself. We have this innate desire for validation. Man, we do this with our kids, don't we? They put all their validation in things. Being the best player on the team, having this, owning this. And again, do not mishear me, right? If you love playing sports and you want your kids to play sports, go let them do it, man. If they can make it all the way to the professional level, go for it. Don't anticipate it happening, but go for it. But here's the problem. When we pour all of their validation into those things and they fall short, guess what? They are left empty, unfulfilled. What we have to pour into ourselves and into our kids and those that we love is, man, go, like, live your dreams, pursue your dreams. But at the end of the day, your validation, your fulfillment, your identity, your worth is not found in any of those things. If you are not the best player on the team, if you never make it to play college baseball, if you never make it to the NFL, if you're not the smartest kid in the class, and by the way, at some point, they will not be. Wake up call. At some point, they're not going to be the smartest kid. At some point, they're not going to be the most athletic. At some point, someone else will come along who is a little better, a little smarter, a little more talented. Like, Devin, you haven't seen my kids swing the bat. Okay. Maybe they'll get there one day and they can buy City Church a building. Yay. But in the meantime, pour into your kids. Go live your dreams. Go fulfill the things that you're talented at doing. But at the end of the day, we find our validation. We find our worth. We find who we are in one place only. So that when you're not the smartest, brightest, most talented, you do not lose the identity of who you are. That I am a child of God. And if that means I'm an awesome athlete, great. If that means I'm a smart kid, great. If it means I'm sitting the bench, great. If it means I'm barely passing, great. My identity and worth is found in Jesus and Jesus alone. Here's the issue here. It's what they're going through. They're seeking this validation. What makes you special, listen, what makes you special is not how awesome you are. What makes you special is who you are in Christ. That you are a child of the living God. And that makes you unique. And that makes you different. And that makes you special, just like we see in this text. So pursue your dreams. But in the end, do not allow your identity to be found in anything or anyone outside of Jesus. He is what makes us distinct. And when you don't have, fill in the blank, you still have Jesus. So Moses begs, right? He begs for God to be with them. He pleads for his presence. And once again, God says to Moses, for the sake of you, Moses, for your sake, I will be with you. Moses, I believe in you. Remember what God said last week? Like, I'll take them all out and start again with you. We kind of see that again here. Moses, for your sake, I will be with you. And I love Moses' response. Moses is basically like, God, can we get this in writing? Can we confirm this somehow? That's verse 17. The Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. Moses said, please show me your glory. This is Moses saying, like, can we get this in writing? Verse 19, and he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there's a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I've passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. So a lot going on here. Moses says, God, I need some confirmation here. Will you show me your glory? Show me who you are. God's like, look, Moses, let me shoot straight with you. You cannot see me and live. How holy I am. You're sinful. I am holy. You cannot see me and live, but here's what I'll do. I'll hide you in a cave, and I will proclaim my name to you. I will tell you who I am, and I'll allow you to catch a glimpse of my goodness. Moses is being protected from God by God. That's grace. I will hide you in a way that you can catch a glimpse of me, but to look fully on me, God says, you cannot even live. So that's what happens. Bounce to 34, verse 6. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. So that's what happens. God passes before Moses in some tangible, very tame, veiled form. We don't know exactly what's going on here, but God allows Moses to catch a glimpse, and then he proclaims who he is to Moses. And what a glorious resume that God puts forth, right? The name in that culture meant everything. People were named based on their character. God proclaims his name here, and what a great reminder of who God is. Like, look at how God describes himself. By the way, this is important because it lets us know what type of God he is. If he's not the things we just read, we are all in a heap of trouble. It lets us see who God is. God says, I am merciful and compassionate. God genuinely cares about you. You get that? He genuinely cares for you. By his very nature, he is a merciful and compassionate God. He says, I am gracious. You know what that means? That means God shows undeserved favor to those who are not even worthy of it. That's the whole story of the Exodus. There's nothing that Israel did to deserve this. And God says, I am gracious. You are undeserving, but I'm gracious. You're bowing down to a golden calf, but I am gracious. I am a merciful, compassionate, gracious God, showing undeserved grace and mercy to those who are not worthy of it. God says, I am slow to anger. I'm slow to anger. God is patient to those who are deserving wrath. Here's how I describe that. God does not have a hair trigger. He is patient. He is slow to anger. I don't know about you, but I'm thankful that God is patient and slow to anger. I don't always respond and act that way. Sometimes I feel like I'm quicker, right? I get to anger more quickly than I do to patience. I'm a reactionary person. You talk to my kids, like, tell me about your dad. What are the great things? And their list will be, I don't know, pretty short. But here's what are the things your dad struggles with? Number one on the list, I can guarantee you, would be my dad reacts. He's reactionary. Zach just said amen. You guys heard Zach for the first and last time from this stage, by the way. Slow to anger. God is slow to anger. I love this phrase that he uses here too. I am abounding in steadfast love. You know what that word abounding means? It means like overflowing. Overflowing in every way. I am abounding in steadfast love. This word steadfast love comes from the Hebrew word that means he is loyal. Covenant loyalty. Covenant loyalty. By the way, in the middle of inconsistency from the Israelites and rebellion against him, he is abounding in covenant loyalty and steadfast love. He is faithful, the text says. He is trustworthy and reliable to the unfaithful and the unreliable. He is forgiving, he describes himself here. Forgiveness flows from his nature. It is who he is. He is a forgiving God. So when we read this text, when we read the name of God, we are reminded that God is glorious. He is glorious. He is so glorious that we must be hidden in a cave for him to even pass before us. And yet, while he is glorious and holy, he is merciful, overflowing in steadfast love. As a matter of fact, we don't have time to dig into this, but God is so glorious, he is so holy, that Moses has to veil his face when he comes off of the mountain, when he talks to the people, because his face is shining so brightly from being in the presence of this consuming holy fire. And yet, God is so merciful that he comes down to his sinful people and offers forgiveness to them. He is so glorious that Moses is like putting a veil on his face so the people can even talk to him. And yet God is so merciful that even though the people have rebelled against him in complete idolatry, God steps into the space. He is merciful to them. That's what 34 is about, God renewing this covenant with his people through Moses. Again, not because of how awesome or faithful they are, but because of verse 6 that we just read, because of who God is. Now, chapters 35 through 40 are just kind of they're the actual construction of the tabernacle we talked about a few weeks ago, the contents of the tabernacle, as well as the making of the priestly garments. If you want to know all about that, you go back and listen to a couple of weeks ago. But that process of constructing the tabernacle, making the priestly garments, all those things, they're a constant reminder to the people that God is near, that his presence is there, that he is with them, that he is holy, but he is also near. And then look how the book of Exodus ends. Let's end our series by looking at just the last few verses. Chapter 40, verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud, which symbolized again God's presence, the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, wherever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, and the people would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and the fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So you have these visual, these tangible reminders of God's presence with his people. In the end, these last few verses, we're reminded God is bigger, he's holier than we can even grasp. Did you see what we just read? Like, Moses could not even roll up into the tabernacle because the glory of God filled it. And Moses could not even enter in. Moses was called a friend of God just a few chapters, and he had to stay away because of the glory and the holiness of God. And yet, God is with them. When the cloud moved, they moved. Fire was there at night to symbolize God's presence. He is near. He is always with us. He is leading us. He is protecting us. He is God. What a beautiful picture at the end of this book. As wonderful as this picture is at the end of Exodus, it is a mere shadow of the closeness of God that is available to us. For every individual who turns from their sin and embraces in faith God's gift of salvation, he takes up residence in our hearts. He dwells within us. He is our God, and he lives inside of us. Not in a temple, a tabernacle that we can not even step into. We are the temple. We are the tabernacle. He lives inside of us through Jesus Christ. So, as we end the series, I bring us back just to these simple truths that we've seen again and again. One, God is holy. He's holy. He's more holy than you can begin to comprehend. Acknowledge his holiness, which in part is recognizing the depth of my own depravity. That I am sinful and in need of a Savior. God is holy. He is a consuming fire. Yet, second thing we've emphasized through this whole series, God is merciful, isn't he? He is merciful. His holiness does not keep him at a distance, but because he is a God of mercy, he comes down to us, he draws near to us. Which also reminds us, as we have said again and again in this series, God is holy, God is merciful, and then the emphasis today, like, we need God. We must have him. Because he is a God that is glorious and holy, because he is a God who is absolutely merciful, we need him. We must have God. The early church fathers called it the God-shaped hole that exists in our soul. There is a hole in our souls that only God can fulfill. That we need his presence. That we are made for his glory. That it is the cry of our hearts. Yet, we are rebellious, aren't we? We are a rebellious people. Our hearts are filled with sin and idolatry. We try to fill the God-shaped hole with our own stuff. which is why we've seen week after week after week, and I leave us with this in this series. We need a deliverer. We need a rescuer. We get God because of Jesus. We get God because of Jesus. As we have said every week, Jesus is the greater Moses. He's the fulfillment. He is the true rescuer, the one who stands between a holy God and sinful humans, including Moses. Jesus is the go-between. He is the perfect one. The gospel is the story of how God draws near to us in the form of Jesus Christ, who lives a sinless life in perfect obedience and offers himself as the once and for all sacrifice for our sin. In Jesus, we gaze on the glory of God. In Christ, we see God for who he is. Look upon him today. Gaze upon him today. Behold him. Listen to me. To those in need of mercy and grace, he is compassionate. To those who cannot measure up, he is gracious and forgiving. To those who are rebellious and sinful, he is slow to anger. To those who are unfaithful, he abounds in faithful love and loyalty. To those who are guilty and ashamed, he is forgiving. The story of the Exodus is our story. It's our story of redemption. That once we were in bondage to sin, enslaved by an evil tyrant, under the sentence of death, but by the blood of the Lamb, we have been delivered from the curse of sin. And now God is with us. He dwells in us. And he goes before us to that final promised land. We face challenges, temptation, obstacles. We stumble, we fall. But he is faithful. He is holy. He is merciful. He is holy, he is near, and we respond. We respond as Moses responded. 34:8, last verse of Exodus we will read. This is after God declares who he is to Moses. Look at Moses' response. And Moses, look at this next word, what? Quickly, when he sees God for who he is, he understands who God is. Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. When Moses saw who God is, his immediate response was not to stand and seek validation through something he's accomplished, or I'm the intercessor, or you're going to annihilate all them and start fresh with me. When Moses sees God for who he is, he falls on his face to the ground and he worships the one true God. That's the only natural response for those who have encountered the bigness, holiness, and mercy of God, is to respond in mercy, to say, you are everything that I am not, and I need you. We humble ourselves in worship, and we proclaim who he is, and we proclaim how we need him. So that's what we do this morning. As we end Exodus, we see how big he is. He is holy and yet merciful.